This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Greetings, I am Barry. If you're searching for answers, spiritual help, clairvoyant readings, healings, crystals, books, incense, or jewellery, you need to go to Infinity, Hamilton Spiritual Centre, in the new premises at 550 Anglesey Street. Or you can phone us on 838 1838. This is your link between this life and the next. Become the change the world needs today.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me calling you? Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me, Ronnie? Can you hear me calling you?
The Voice Within, your connection between this world and the next. Brought to you by Infinity Spiritual Center, 550 Anglesey Street, Hamilton.
Greetings, I'm Barry. Now this week we've got an interview from Expanding Reality. And it's about what we had for the last few weeks. It's about Michel Marquet and his abduction to the ninth planet.
Welcome to Expanding Reality. I am your host, Brandon Thomas. On this very, very special episode, guys, we have Samuel Chong joining us to talk about a book written by a guy named Michel Demarquet that he just got so obsessed with that he went to go find the author in Vietnam, and it's just an incredible story. So the book that we are discussing today is called The Abduction to the Ninth Planet, a.k.a. The Thayuba Prophecy, The Golden Planet. Now, this is a true report by the author who was physically abducted to another planet, and it's one of the coolest damn stories ever, guys. This is why I started this show, is for this story right here. It's got everything. First of all, Samuel is incredible. Samuel Chong, which all the ways again to find him and the book, of course, will be located down in the show notes. But on this one, we talk not only about the abduction experience that Michelle encountered and Thao and all of the, guides and characters and animals and structures and planets and everything in this story, but also we cover, former lives, ghosts, mind power, planetary categories, ancient mythology on our planet that's actually very interesting on others, the Bermuda Triangle, vortices, time slips, missing time, Moses, Jesus. Like, this goes so far, and it is one of the coolest damn stories I've ever heard. So you guys are absolutely going to love this episode, and you're going to love Samuel because, again, he's amazing. Welcoming to the show, we have Samuel Chong hanging out with us. Samuel, how are you, brother?
Good, very good.
Good. Well, you are the representative for an amazing book by Michel Demarquet, which we are going to get into here, The Thayuba Prophecy. Did I say it right? I know everybody mispronounces it. How do you pronounce
Thayuba.
It? Thayuba. Okay. Thayuba, yes. Prophecy, The Golden Planet, which was formerly called The Abduction to the Ninth Planet. Amazing book, guys. So, of course, all the ways to find Samuel, as well as this amazing piece of literature right here, will be located down in the show notes, so make sure that you guys check that out. One of the coolest damn stories I have ever heard in my entire life. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. It's mind-blowing. It's whimsical. It's fun. It really makes your mind go. And so this is one of the coolest things is finding a story like this that just really lets your imagination wander. And we on the show here, that's the name of it, Expanding Reality. And this single book right here does exactly that. So let's talk about it, man. First of all, how the hell did you find this damn book?
Well, I was searching for information on Amazon, especially for books related to messages from ET contactees. I was looking for information so that I can learn, especially the ET technologies or something related to how we can evolve at much faster pace. So I accidentally stumbled upon this book, and I checked out from the library, and I found the book extremely fascinating because, different from other ET contactee books, this book is very specific on so many details. And we can relate to in our real world, and we can also check the evidence out.
You know, I heard your conversation with Karin Swain. Now, I've had Karin on the show before. She's a good friend of the show. She's a great friend of mine, and she's just a delight. So she actually is the one that recommended that you and I connect, and I'm so grateful that she did. This is one of those things. Now, it's interesting. I don't feel that this found me accidentally. I really do look at this as a synchronicity. So do you think still in this current day that you found the book accidentally, or do you feel like you were kind of guided to it, or that there was a higher purpose behind your discovery of it?
I think there is a higher purpose because I was always fascinated by the mysteries in the universe. And the reason that I was able to locate the author without really knowing where exactly he was living at that time, that meant something. And also, I think this is my life purpose, is to spread the messages in the book. We are really at a critical moment of time. I mean, our human history is at a very critical moment of time. And I think my life purpose is just to let as many people know about this book as possible so that people can really act accordingly.
Awesome. Well, we're going to definitely get you a few more here today. So this is right on par. You're right on brand. I'm telling you, I'm so excited about this conversation. So you sent me a digital copy of the book, but that wasn't good enough. I dove into this and just went ahead and ordered one. And man, I've got a ton of notes in here. I've got a ton of questions for you. So let's get started with the author, Michel Desmarquez. How did you meet him?
Well, you know, in the postscript of this book, it says there are more things that the author, Michel Desmarquez, was not allowed to write in the book. I was very curious about that, many things that he was not allowed to write in the book. So I was determined to look for him. And I searched on the internet and found a photo of a traveler who took where Michel Desmarquez was living at that time, just a photo of the bungalow. And then I showed the photo to the taxi driver after I landed in the southern Vietnam. And then the taxi driver took me there. And then there I found Michel Desmarquez.
This is what's so wild, with a picture. And it cost you a lot of money to go fly over to Vietnam to find this guy just because of the postscript of a book that he wrote, and you wanted to ask him more questions in person. It's fascinating, man. Why were you so motivated and driven to do that?
I'm always a very curious person. I'm very curious about many things in the world, how the governments are run and how the world politics are going to the way that they are right now, and especially to the ET technologies and ET messages. I'm always very curious about what we as human beings need to learn to evolve at much faster pace. And I think we are just too slow to move up to the ladder. I really wanted to get a shortcut. So I think by reading this book, by meeting the author, asking questions about how we can evolve, and I think that's a shortcut. I always want to take the shortcut, a faster route.
Well, I love it because it sounds like the most adventurous thing, just to go on a, I mean, that's the whole motivation for you buying a ticket, just to go meet this guy, ask him a few questions because you're so curious and intrigued about the story that he wrote. And you fly all the way to Vietnam to go meet the guy. It's absolutely fascinating, man. So let's just launch into it. So do you want to talk about the abduction with me?
Yes. Well, it happened in the year 1987. The author, Michel Desmarquez, he woke up in the middle of the night. He didn't know why, but he wrote a note to his wife saying that he would be gone for 10 days and there's absolutely no need to worry about him. And then he walked outside of his house and he was lifted up in the middle of the air. And then they first arrived in a very unique location, which is a parallel universe. He saw a lot of strange people in the medieval times and also some of the what we call savages. And it was explained that the reason they first went into a parallel universe was to prevent people on Earth from seeing them. And then after that, after a few encounters, he was brought into the spaceship. And on the way to the planet Theoba, they stopped by another planet called Arima X3, where he saw the devastation after nuclear war. And then, but after arriving on the planet Theoba, he had a very, very interesting experience. And he was explained many of the mysteries on Earth, such as who built the Great Pyramid of Egypt, and for what purpose, what happened to the people and the ships and planes who went missing in the Bermuda Triangle, and where did the black people, the yellow people, and Caucasian people, and Jewish people come from? And what happened to the stories in the Bible? Who sent Moses and Jesus Christ to us? And very interesting facts that people really can remember by.
It's amazing. This book has it all. I'm telling you, it covers the paranormal, ghosts, ETs, interplanetary living, the chakra system. Whenever they get to the end there, and we'll get there. But one of the things I wanted to point out about the abduction itself is it's so interesting because he writes in here, and it's straight out the gate. There's a foreword and the abduction, a preface and the abduction. It goes right for it. So one of the interesting things that I thought about this was in where he says that he woke up at about 12:30 a.m., which is not like him at all. He doesn't usually wake up at that hour. He took his pajamas off and put pants and trousers and dress to go out, like to be social out in public. Writes his wife a little note, which, I mean, that's amazing in itself, that in 1987, I don't know if wives are different now, but I don't know that my wife would care for that very much, or, you know, say, yeah, you can go, you know, just be gone for 10 days and that's fine. But that was something very interesting that I thought. So what do you think motivated him to get out of his pajamas, put on pants, write the note and leave?
I think the ETs knew about him and also his wife. His wife was kind of a very suspicious person in a sense that she still thinks that the author, Michel de Marquet, had an affair with another woman. So to this day, his wife just doesn't believe what happened to him. But his family, other members of his family, like his son, believes everything happened to him, but not his daughter. So his family is divided. I think the ETs know every single thing about him and his family. I think that's the reason.
Yeah, and you know, and when he comes back as the chapter returning home, that's when he explains to his wife, hey, just let me sleep. He sleeps for like 36 hours. And again, guys, I'll link all this in the show notes. You've got to get this damn book. It's one of the most amazing reads ever, because even if it is a story made up and that, yeah, he did just go gallivanting for 10 days or something, it's one of the coolest, most elaborate, and it's full of a lot of wisdom. And it's really, really interesting. So it doesn't matter to me if it's real or not. I have a tendency to think that people that experience this type of thing really do experience this type of thing in one form or another. This entire thing in my mind also could have just been a dream, but there are such interesting details in it and such an interesting experience that it's not like writing off a dream as just like, oh, that was a dream and whatever. It has some such profound experiences in it that it more mirrors in my mind like a psychedelic experience, to where he's taken on this trip, he learns a lot of things, he walks around, and again, we're going to get to this, but one of the interesting parts about this was that he just put clothes on and left and wrote the note, floated up. And then another interesting part was whenever him and Thao, isn't it? His guide.
Thao.
Yes, Thao. Also kind of like a Dante and Virgil story. It's almost like the, you know, Dante's Inferno, to where he has a guide that takes him. He is whisked off somewhere else. Issues with the wife. So there's a lot of parallels there with that story also. Now, something that I found interesting was whenever they were ascending up into the ship, she grabbed her belt and said, just don't touch me at all. Why do you think in your mind that whenever they were ascending up to the ship, she was very overemphasized, do not touch me whatsoever until I tell you to. And then once they were on the ship, she said, okay, we can touch now. So what was that about?
I believe that they're using a kind of magnetic system or electromagnetic system to lift themselves up. So I think if Michel de Marquet really touched Tao at that moment of time, it would interfere with the force, the electromagnetic force that would cause a lot of issues with their system. So I think that's a very technical issue in which the author, Michel de Marquet, really didn't explain to me why that's the reason. I don't know if that fact was explained to him by Tao or not, but that was written in the book. There are a lot of things written in the book that are not really explained by Tao. I guess we'll just have to do our own homework and to find out the reasons.
Absolutely. And Tao even says in here, when he was asking about the speed, and we're going to get to the ship, when he was asking about the speed that it travels, she said, oh, like several times the speed of light. And he wanted more details and she couldn't give it to him. And she even explains in here as sort of a disclaimer, hey, there's going to be a lot of things. We're going to go through a lot of information. I'm not going to be able to go into super detail about all of them, but just know that this is the answer that I have provided for you now. It's very interesting. So let's talk about the ship. Because that thing is crazy. So what are some of your favorite details about when he was brought on board the ship?
My favorite detail is that they really went through a disinfection process. They used yellow light and blue light to disinfect him. It killed about over 90% of the germs and the bacteria and the viruses. So I think I looked it up on the internet, and I found out that blue light indeed has antibacterial antiviral effects. It's done by the researchers at Harvard Medical University or Harvard Medical School. And they found out that the blue light is really a very effective way to kill or to disinfect people or objects. I think that has a very, very strong implications to what we are happening right now. There are companies in China that are really using this blue light to disinfect or come up with products to help people. And I think this is something that we need to look into, and because it's cheap and inexpensive and effective.
Absolutely. And I didn't look it up, but now I'm just curious. So when the UV type disinfectant, because we saw that a lot with what happened in 2020, that people were running around with these UV lights disinfecting things. And I'm not sure if that was around in the 80s. Honestly, I didn't look it up. So audience, if you find that out, write me in. But, you know, it's interesting that this type of explanation that he has, probably there wasn't an example for in our reality. So that part of it was fascinating to me as well. And especially whenever the bright yellow, you know, and he's like, oh, what kind of paint is that? And she's like, oh, it's just the room. It's not paint, you know, and then it changed to that blue. And then another interesting detail was, and of course, you know, she was wearing a clear helmet whenever they met and then didn't need it once they were after a certain period of time, but then gave him a clear helmet to wear whenever they were kind of in the boxes and rising up off the planet. One of the interesting things I thought also about this was the pills that she gave him. So do you want to talk about that?
Yes, after he took the pills and his astral body left his physical body, he was able to really float around and follow Tao, our hostess, and to see everything and to hear everything, but Tao was not able to see him. So his astral body actually left his physical body by just taking the pill and also drinking a liquid.
Yeah, she gives him two pills, one to do the rest of the job of the bacteria on the inside, which I wanted to ask you just your opinion about. You know, we have our bacteria in our bodies are the reason that we're able to survive. And so, you know, do you think that it just maybe neutralized the bacteria rather than killed it off or just kind of kept it? Maybe what's the explanation for that? Because if you took a pill that killed the bacteria that was harmful to others, it may also not let you survive as well. That bacteria is necessary for us.
Right. I think it just neutralized the bad bacteria, and now the good ones, the beneficial ones are kept. And I think the reason that his astral body had to leave his physical body is that the vibrations caused by the pills are really or were really harmful to the astral body. If the astral body were kept into his physical body, it would interfere with the vibrations of his astral body.
How wild is that? That you're doing something internally, and so they give you like a break while you, yeah. You know, and this is something I think that, and a lot of people think happen when you dream, right? That your body needs the rest, but your spirit or your astral body perhaps does not. And so you go travel and you have adventures, and maybe that's what dreams are, right? It was also interesting that he was able to watch Tao pick him up and put him in this box, which I want to talk to you about as well. And then, but meters away from his body, as he said, he moved with the speed of thought. So that's astral body. Now, again, this could be written off. I don't think it is, but it could be written off as just a dream or something like that, because now you're observing things. And even Tao said, just like you said, that I'm not going to be able to see or hear you, but she kept openly speaking as if he could hear her while they were just walking around and stuff. So it's very interesting to me, this delineation, and because a lot of contacts that I've talked to, contactees, say that that's what they took. They didn't take their physical body, and that's why they were able to go through walls and doors and all of these things, is because they take your astral body, not your physical body. So have you ever heard of anything like that?
Yeah, I've read a lot of stories about ET contactees, and I think those are really interesting stories. This book, however, is specifically interesting to me because it contains so many specific verifiable details. And I really love this book because this book has a lot of information that I really did a lot of research on.
Hell yeah. It's so much fun, dude. It's so much fun. So again, I'm grateful that we're doing this. So the boxes, and then we'll move on from this. So the boxes were described as what? Coffins without lids, right?
Yes.
Do you know what this made me think of instantly? Is the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, I actually have been to the Great Pyramid and I saw the King's Chamber. And I think it's very interesting that it coincides with the shape of the King's Chamber. I wonder if there's a connection over there.
I know. This is what I'm thinking. This is when you hear like those jump rooms and ancient circle technologies like Avery and Stonehenge and all of that and stargates and things. You know, maybe this box, you know, that they were in and he could, while he was being disinfected and everything, and then astral body was out and he was laying in it. It's almost like a way to kind of keep your body okay while you're running around doing your thing, you know. So I was just thinking that this would be a really cool addition to a pyramid as well, and perhaps that's what that lidless sarcophagus that they never found any mummies in was all about, is some sort of connection there.
Yeah, I think the book also says that the pharaohs used the Great Pyramid the right way of the supposedly to be used, and I think maybe the pharaohs, the kings, used that box when they were traveling in astral bodies.
Yeah. And it's cool because you hear people like Aleister Crowley and stuff like that sleeping in that thing overnight and the vibrations and all of these very interesting things. So that was just something that I definitely wanted to point out with you. So whenever they're running around the ship and he's, you know, in his astral body and walking around to the pilots, or floating around rather to the pilots, and just watching everything happen, do you mind just walking us through your favorite parts of that?
Yeah, I was really surprised that he saw on the screens like the numbers that we use nowadays. And then he was really surprised when Tao told him that the numbers actually came from Theoba, their people. So I was really surprised. Like, I always thought that the numbers actually came from the Arab world, because we Chinese people call them Arabic numerals. Mm-hmm. And actually some people say they came from India, and I think it's true that they came from Theoba, and then they gave it to other people, and they spread it to India and the Arabic world and to us.
Yeah, because there's some interesting examples of Theobans being here, which we are definitely going to get to. So another thing I wanted to point out was whenever they went to the stop before the Golden Planet, there were three spheres that he saw, and one, you know, two went out to the left and right, and one went down. And the zoom that he, you know, was so obsessed with is the fact that he could just follow this thing all the way down. Why do you think they don't cloak those things and let the inhabitants of the planet that they're visiting see those? Because we see that type of thing all the time, because the way it's described is that they're basically probes that go out, these orbs that detach from ships. Now, I've seen dozens and dozens of videos and heard tons of accounts like you have about these motherships or whatever, some lights floating in the sky and orbs dropping from them and then moving on, exactly like what's described in the book. But they don't seem to care if people see them or not.
Right. They don't really seem to care, because I think on that planet, Arimo X3 is a planet that just had a nuclear war. So people there were kind of primitive in a way. So the reason they really wanted to show themselves were really want to help them to indirectly. And I think nowadays we see the probes and we see a lot of things. This is actually a sign of something else, in which is kind of related to one of the things that the author, Michel de Marquet, was not allowed to write in the book. I think the time is coming and we need to really bring ourselves into the level that is necessary for our evolution.
Absolutely. 100% agree. Yeah. So let's talk about the first man on Earth. So tell us about that.
We all came from other planets. The black people and the yellow people came from one planet called Barberatini. And we came from like millions of years ago. And the yellow people and black people, Chinese and the black people, they, on their original planet, they didn't get along in the very beginning, but they, after a few wars, including a nuclear war, they learned how to get along with each other. The important thing was to move up to a more spiritual level and to help each other. And then after we came to Earth, and we had to survive on Earth, which had a very different environment, even from today. And we had to learn how to adapt to the different gravitational forces, and also the mosquitoes, and the yellow people and the black people all had extremely difficulties figuring out how to deal with the yellow fever, which was spread by the mosquitoes. And the yellow people came up with a vaccine and gave it immediately to the black people, and the black people also helped the yellow people in a lot of ways. So the two group of people really helped each other over the number of years, until suddenly one thing happened: an asteroid hit the Earth and then caused a lot of turmoil and Earth changes. The asteroid actually split into three parts. One part, I think, it hit the Red Sea, and the other part hit the East Timor area, and the last part hit the Galapagos Island. So that caused a lot of flooding and volcanic activities. So most of the civilization on Earth at that time were destroyed by this kind of unfortunate natural event.
So, you know, I've heard other people talk about this as well, is that humans aren't from here, like they're from somewhere else. And we hear this with Zechariah Sitchin in the Anunnaki story. We hear it with the Jewish population in spirit science, and they talk about Atlantis and Mu and all that kind of stuff, which we are going to get to as well. And so this idea of humans not being from here, but just found this planet and then here they are in one form or another that led us to what we are now, this is very interesting to me. I've also had a guy on named Dr. Michael P. Masters, and he wrote an awesome book you would absolutely love, by the way, called Identified Flying Objects. And he's an anthropologist, he's a biological anthropologist. And his book, or his idea, is the contention from an anthropologist perspective of looking at hominid skeletons going back, that, you know, aliens or bipedal humanoids could be, you know, future humans coming back in time machines, which I absolutely love, right? It's one of my favorite ones. But what's really interesting about something that he said in relation to this was about bipedalism. So it's actually this upright body, the two legs, two arms, torso, head, all of that stuff is actually a horrible design. It's not good at all. It's not the most optimal design that we could see, especially for the conditions on our planet, with the atmospheric conditions, with the gravity, with everything it takes. Now, it has its advantages, right? Like, so in evolution, they tell us, well, we needed, you know, binocular vision because we're predators, and then we stand upright so we could stand, and we have use of our hands for tools and all of that good stuff. And that's awesome. But one thing that I'm very interested in is the idea that, you know, people or human beings on this planet aren't from here at all. And it was kind of seeded, you know, and this idea of the beings or whatever finding planets all over the place and just saying, yep, that looks like a good one. Because it said, what in the book, that 1,350,000 years ago is when this civilization sent reconnaissance and then found Earth and said, you know what, this is awesome. We're going to set up shop here. And so then they had challenges, just like overcoming the gravity and especially mosquitoes, man. I share that with them. So do you think in any way that they could come down and make the planet more habitable for them, even after the reconnaissance missions? Like they could send something down to kill all the mosquitoes off, or, you know, make it easier on them, maybe even technologically, to handle being bipedal on Earth?
I mean, talking about the black people and the yellow people, they certainly didn't know the dangers of mosquitoes at that time. If you're talking about the Theobans, the ETs coming from the ninth category of planet, I think they really wanted us to learn how to survive and how to respond to the life challenges. So I think they didn't interfere by killing all the mosquitoes on Earth, was just trying to allow us and giving us the opportunity to learn and how to come up with a vaccine for against the yellow fever, and how to really cope with the difficult situations on Earth, so that we can really learn on our own and to have more vivid lessons on the way. One thing I like to point out is that when I was reading this book the first time or second time, I was curious about why the author mentioned, Michel de Marquet mentioned that the planet Bacratini was cooling down. And that's the reason they migrated here, the black people and yellow people. I thought, what do you mean by the planet cooling down? So I did the research. What the author, Michel de Marquet, meant was the core of the Earth, of that planet, was cooling down. So when the core of a planet cools down, it loses the gravity and the atmosphere got lost. So that's why if the atmosphere cannot retain like oxygen and other useful air, and so it will be impossible for any species to survive on that planet anymore. And this is something that happened to Mars 300,000 years ago. So Mars, the core of Mars also cooled down. So the people on Mars had to move to another planet. So that's what happened on Mars. So if anyone like Elon Musk was thinking about moving us to Mars, then I think he needs to reconsider that option.
I agree with you. And I think that there's a lot of interesting ways we could take this conversation, especially bringing flat Earth into the conversation, which I'm a huge fan of just ideologically. I think it's interesting. And so when you look at things like the inner core of a planet cooling down, that goes against what physicists talk about today, as far as having a molten core that is heated and there's molten under there and there's no cavity or anything like a hollow earth or something. So several things about some woo-woo stuff that I just find fun to entertain the thought of were written out immediately with this book. The idea of a hollow earth or a hollow civilization or a civilization living within Earth, also that Earth is flat or something like that. Now, It doesn't necessarily rule them out. It perhaps tells of a story in a way that the author expected to see and be presented with these things. So if this author had never even entertained the extra dimensional time travel, flat earth, inner earth, anything like that, then yes, the experience would present itself in this way because that's what he was most familiar with and would expect. And there's even a quote in here that I'd noted to talk about Thao putting information in his head about, like, saying, okay, right here. So this is an excerpt from it. All that I imagined was this is Thao speaking to the author. All that I imagined was projected into your astro-psychic body, which is as if it was happening. The only thing is not having time to prepare you for the experience. I had to be very cautious. So again, it seems like they have the ability to present any information to us that we wish to see. And even further, it goes on to say, when you create an illusion, the subject or subjects should be prepared to see what you want them to see. So for example, if you want them to see a spaceship in the sky, it is important that they're expecting to see one. Same thing. If this is a reality in which there is interdimensional, and that's the real base reality, perhaps coming to a planet or an area or a realm like ours, you would need to present the experience in this way so that this person didn't get distracted by these other concepts, right? So that yes. They were able to take him on this journey without having to explain, which is, there are tremendous things in this journey that are explained, but then even the basic stuff of the physics of the real way that reality works, if there is an alternative to this globe model, to the vastness of space, to all of that stuff. So that was a lot there, Samuel, but what do you think about that? That basically reality could be a lot different and they just project in your mind what you think that they think that you want to see or expect to see.
I take it as that the Tao, the ETs from this planet, they are the masters of the mind. I mean, they can really project like a vision to us. They know how to do a lot of wonderful things that Jesus did in the past, like levitation and telepathy, and also real magic, which is kind of like a form of projecting a scene and to let people feel that they are really experiencing the realities. And I think it explains a lot of interesting paranormal events on Earth. For example, a lot of people actually saw the tears of the Fatima. And I think this book mentions that that's actually an illusion created by a chain reaction. Is actually something that people should note for it.
Yeah. And this mass psychosis, these mass sightings that everybody sees, and they could just be all in the mind. And so this is what's so fascinating to me, is once you get to a level with this, you know, technology, because all high technology at a level is just consciousness, right? And so perhaps at that level, they can kind of know, you know, what you're able to mentally take in, even though this, again, the story is so phenomenal and fantastic, and he does, it's such an adventure. But even that, they perhaps don't give him all of the information or all of the knowledge about the true existence of reality. I mean, you could just be, you know, one of the things I say all the time is you could be a brain in a vat somewhere, just being fed electrical signals, and that's your existence, right? And it would feel the same, just the same ability that they have to project these images or these screen memories that we hear a lot about in contactee cases into people's minds to make you think that that's what happened. And I don't know. I don't really trust any of it. Do you trust ETs? I'm just curious on a side note here.
I do. A good side note. It's a very good point. A lot of ET contactees have this kind of horrifying and terrifying experiences of feeling the fear or terror. I think that's actually done by government black operations, because the U.S. government has the technology already to project images into people's mind. And I do believe that the horrifying, terrifying experiences are actually done by the black operations. But the ETs, I mean, if you think about it, if the ETs really want to kill us or enslave us, they would have done that a long time ago. They could have done that thousands or millions of years ago. They didn't need to wait. They don't need to wait until now to do this to us. So I think the ETs are actually, especially this group of ETs, are actually helping us and guiding us like mentors, guiding us to the right path. And actually, they have done that many times in the past. It's been recorded in the Bible and also a lot of ancient scriptures.
Yeah, the motives are interesting, because even the people that say that they've had horrible experiences, and this, you can say this again with psychedelic experiences, with life after death experiences, all of these things, there's a percentage, and it's a very small percentage, that say it was a horrible experience. One star, one Yelp review, right? And then it does, though, seem that if they can be manipulative at that level, one could then just assume, or maybe make a logical, not too far jump to say that perhaps they implant in your mind things that you hated, that then they go, no, you actually love that. Like, everything was awesome. And so really the small percentage of people that say it was horrible perhaps are the ones that aren't as susceptible to the mind control. And they can say, no, it was actually a horrible experience. But then a higher percentage of people say, no, it was a wonderful experience. But again, if they have the power of the mind that they do, they could just convince you that you had a great time or that you went on this awesome adventure and it wasn't. Again, I'm very skeptical, which I know the Chinese people are as well. And so you share this with me, but I'm also a lover of this kind of cool stuff. And this, I'm a huge fan of it. I just, again, want to bring that into the conversation to just kind of make it a round thing here. So let's definitely talk about Mu and Easter Island. So you've been to Easter Island, which is crazy cool. What was that like?
It's a very interesting island, and I was trying to find information and just to see how receptive the people are to this kind of knowledge, where the statues came from. And I found that it's kind of very unfortunate that people were trying to survive and trying to live a very pleasurable life on that island. And they were really kind of not looking for a lot of information like we have been talking about. But the island is very beautiful, and it's fascinating. It's one of the most unique places I've visited, and it's a very remote place, and it took me a while to plan that trip. And it's better to know Spanish on that island, because people don't speak English that well.
Yeah, so I've always been curious, because I've heard the journey is crazy just to get out to Easter Island. So tell us about that journey.
We flew from Los Angeles to Santiago, Chile, and then we took the plane to, I think, Lanchile to Easter Island. And We're really lucky. We found my family members, they don't speak Spanish, so they relied on the tour guide who spoke English. That's very nice. And we kind of traveled the whole island and saw the statues, the moas, and also we saw a lot of the volcanic volcanoes and very interesting experience on that island. My son actually read a book about prophecy, but unlike me, he was not really into it, but he read it as a science fiction.
And that's fine. I mean, because even so, there's a ton of wisdom in here. Now, I'm like you. I take it as like, I think it's awesome. And it'd be crazy cool if it's real. It doesn't need to be real for me to consider that's an experience that this gentleman had. Like, I don't need for someone else to validate their personal experience for me to say that they didn't have it, right? Because there's no way for any of us to prove this. And I'm not interested in that game anyway. I think it's an awesome story and I dig the hell out of it. So, the Easter Island thing is very interesting as well, because wasn't it part of a huge, larger continent or a bunch of islands before they sank?
Right. Before, it was part of the continent of Lemuria, and it sank 14,500 years ago. And it was actually like a quarry where they had this kind of specific stones they were trying to build to commemorate the people from Theoba. On Lemuria, back then, when people were living there, they had a very unique civilization that was far more advanced than what we have nowadays. On that continent, they didn't have money. People were highly evolved in the sense that no one took advantage of another person. They went to the supermarket, they went to the market in the city of the town, and then they just took what they needed without any waste or anything that just they took what was necessary for them to live. And they exchanged everything just based on established laws and regulations. Everyone followed the rules. No one took any deviations from the laws. So it was a very, very interesting description written in the book. I strongly suggest people to read it and to see if we can really imitate the civilization on Lemuria. But unfortunately, the technologies that they had on that continent, they didn't let the other people know at that time. So when the continent sank, the technologies such as anti-gravitational technologies and supersonic vibrational systems that they used to cut the stones in a very precise manner, those technologies got lost. But some of them really passed down to Atlantis, and then where they used the technologies to build the Great Pyramid of Egypt and also other like other interesting like places on Earth.
Yeah, across Mesoamerica. I mean, there's so many consistencies across building styles, and especially just the thought of the pyramid anyway. So one of the quotes from the book as well was, "On your planet, money is the worst of all evils. Now try to imagine life without money." And the author and Tao go into this, and they talk about, you know, you see that Tao would have read my efforts. If you can't imagine such a life, you are caught up in the system. So this is the thing, and it's very tricky. And I've heard this as well about that you can't manifest things that your mind can't imagine or that you can't visualize. So even that, a life without, you know, a planet without money, what's that look like? And so from our perspective, and this is delineated in the book as well, I was happy you did it, was, oh, well, that's socialism. And it's like, well, no, it's not. At a mature level, if it's executed correctly, it's not socialism. This is just like having the unity consciousness idea with someone in the third dimension, right? Or a lower... not lower hierarchical, just lower spatially. They're not as curious about the higher concepts of consciousness. You can't tell somebody that you're all one and then them jump immediately to the, oh, well, I can just go kill people because I can just go kill anybody I want because we all just return to source. We're all the same thing, right? There's a level of maturity. There's a gap in goal, right? Between what we can visualize and what it would look like implemented from the perception that we have on the planet that we do, being a part of the system that we have been for so damn long. So even concepts like this, which is another reason, again, guys, I'm going to link this down in the show notes. Highly, highly recommend it. Now, whenever we talk about Lemuria, Mu, Atlantis, all of these older civilizations, the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, and all these wonderful, wonderful stories, what happened to those people?
I mean, after the Earth changes, actually, Lemuria, Atlantis actually were the continents sunk into the ocean. The book really doesn't talk about Atlantis, how Atlantis sunk, but for Lemuria, it was caused by earthquakes and also the gaseous belts beneath the continent, and then volcanic activities, and also everything happened in a very sudden, in a very short time. And the author, Michel de Marquet, actually relived the days when the continent of Lemuria sunk into the ocean. And he saw how horrifying the entire experience was. And also, it's really like a natural catastrophe. It's not something like a war or something like that. But it makes me really think what we need to be prepared of in the future, especially with the current situations, climate change or anything. But more importantly, how to really live more in a more spiritual way, because the book keeps emphasizing that the danger is not nuclear bomb. The danger is the way we live. And we really need to think about it.
Completely agree. Again, it's that jump. It's that gap in the goal that we've got. There's a big gap in between even what we can conceptualize and what it will take for us to survive as a species, if that's something that we're interested in doing. Mm-hmm. You know, again, with these natural disasters, with all of this, with Lemuria being such a high, enlightened, technologically advanced, even though it was in a different form, it was what we would call magic. You know, how was there no way to determine that this was about to happen to them? Or was it just a destiny thing or something nefarious? Or like, I would think that a civilization that's in tune spiritually knows the earth and knows a lot about the earth, or that technologically advanced, would have some sort of like inkling that this was going to happen, kind of like the planet that's whose core was dying and cold. Like, they had the foresight and they had time to be able to go, oh, we've detected this, things are getting colder, we got to go somewhere else, and they just jumped ship to go to another planet. We don't really have that option. So it seems interesting, again, that these Lemurians, you know, had all these advanced technology, couldn't see it. We have some early warning detections. I wouldn't call us technologically advanced, but like, we'd be screwed if something like that happened, and it would just be over for us.
One thing we have to keep in mind is that Lemuria, the people on Lemuria, also lived on Earth, which is a Category 1 planet. It's not Category 2 or 3. It's pretty primitive and basic, just like elementary schools. So people there, although they had advanced technologies, and they really probably didn't really focus on earthquakes at that time. You know, one detail in the book was that there was like a meeting of seven important, the highest leaders of that continent. And then there was like a suggestion that the earthquake was about to happen. And then I think there were a lot of warning signals to the king of Lemuria at that time. But it was too late. I think it's just like when you are the ruler of the of a country, and there are always different voices and voicing different opinions. Some say the earthquake is going to be very strong. Some say no need to worry about the earthquake. Just like nowadays, like if someone is the president, and some people are going to say the vaccines are good for people, and some people are going to say the vaccines are bad for people, there are just it will be really difficult for the ruler or the decision maker if someone is not wise enough to make the right decision. I think this is happening nowadays too. A very unfortunate event.
It's very interesting, and I'm on board with your perspective, man. Again, very enlightened. I dig the hell out of this. So let's talk about the Golden Planet. All right, so Golden Planet, man, go. When they get there, what's going on?
So first, before arriving on that planet, on that planet, Michel de Marquet saw a golden mist surrounding that planet. Everything is like so bright and so beautiful. After he landed, he was given like a helmet, like a sunglasses to filter out the sunlight and also the strong colors, because on that planet everything shines so brightly that it would hurt or maybe make Michel de Marquet dizzy because of the strong colors and the strong lights. And also another thing is that the gravity on that planet is lighter than on Earth. So Michel de Marquet had to really be careful when he was moving around. If he really uses the force too strongly, he would have jumped up maybe a few meters. So he really had to be careful. His ego really wanted, his ego was really expecting like a red carpet and the leaders of the planet Theoba welcoming him, but it didn't happen for a very good reason, because his purpose of visiting the planet was not really to be like a guest. He was more like like someone who made mistakes, or someone to be taught a lesson. So in that role, he would land it on that planet. That's why when he really was expecting like a welcoming team, or it really didn't happen. Instead, after the first day, when he was led to the seven great masters of that planet, he was really taught spiritual lessons, or taught very important knowledge that he had to write a book on and then to let us know about it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's like going to university out of state. You know, you think, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to college for the first time. This is great. And then you just show up and they're like, here's your schedule. Go to class. You know, you're here to do something. You're here for a purpose. I think that's funny. So what is one of the most mind-blowing things that you think about the Golden Planet? I mean, besides all of them, there's so many mind-blowing things. But what's one of your favorites, or a few of your favorites?
I think everything is. One of the most mind-blowing, actually two. One is that they can really make water from air. They can also move around using this kind of small device, anti-gravitational force, and also kind of magnetic force that people really didn't need cars or trains to move around. And the second thing is that their food is kind of like a powder that releases calories in different times, so that one would not need to eat anything within 48 hours. So those two things are really interesting. And also among other things, like how they, this is not written in the book, but Michel de Marquet said in an interview that they received information by kind of downloading information from another person, from another Theoban. For example, if they want to learn everything about the Earth, then they would download the information from the expert of that subject matter, and they would instantaneously know everything about Earth. So this is very interesting. Also about the animals, it's just so many things.
I know. Well, tell us about the animals. Go ahead. I think it's great. I love your passion with this, by the way. You're just so great to be doing this. Go ahead.
Yeah, Michel de Marquet saw like very interesting and strange animals on that planet. A lot of the animals he saw really were imprinted or shown on the pyramid, where he saw the Lemurians people, the Lemurian pyramid, like animals with human head, or animals that look like human, but they have animal heads. He also saw like a horse woman, and heard the horse woman speaking in a language that sounded like a human language. And the horse woman just galloped very, very rapidly, and also kind of communicating with Tao, his host, on Theoba. He also saw like dolphins. Dolphins are spiritual animals, and they're the smartest animals on Earth, probably. And Tao specifically mentioned to Michel de Marquet that the dolphins are really unique animals, and they have dolphins on Theoba as well. One other thing is that the people on Theoba, they really didn't have this kind of false modesty. So they only wear clothes when needed to. For example, when they walked on the beach, everyone was naked, and they only they took a they kind of see clothes as a something that to wear on just to for functional use, not to hide embarrassment or something like that. And when Michel de Marquet saw them being naked, then he confirmed that they're really hermaphrodites, like having male and female sexual organs. Fascinating information.
It really is. And yes, the modesty thing was very interesting. And I'd loved it when Tao told him about, you know, because near the end of the book, they talk about why they were hermaphrodites. And so she even said, oh, I can't believe it took you this long to ask, you know what I mean? Because they were like at the very end of it, right? And I guess he was just nice or something. So he didn't want to be rude, right? And so one of the interesting things I thought about her description of that is because they've transcended. They're the most advanced thing out there. They're a category 9 planet, right? And it's one of these things to where, like, once you get to a certain level, it's all you. You know, it's all, everything happens within you. And they can just create bodies and create everything out of, you know, other means than by sexual reproduction. So there's no real need for them to be in that form of duality. They've transcended it. And they even talked about the different energetic systems, like the 9 different bodies, like your astral body, and that relates to the 6 major points, like your chakra systems. And all of that is in the book, guys. So I'm not going to go any further into it. Get the damn book. It's one of the best investments in your mind that you will make, is reading this damn thing. So with the animals, I thought it was interesting too. These horse women that he saw, they had wings tucked in. So now we're talking Pegasuses. Now we're talking chimeras with the Lemurians that he saw with the animal heads on human bodies. So this ties into mythology that's here on Earth. Do you think that that's where we get that mythology from, and that maybe it wasn't mythology, it was just a historical record?
I think it's historical record. It's not mythology. Even in ancient Chinese texts, they talk about different kinds of strange animals and different strange, kind of strange plants. They call that the Shanhai Jing, which is the scriptures of mountains and oceans. So they describe this kind of a very strange place, unique place that people can visit by going on a ship, landing on that continent or place. They would see all this kind of different strange animals, just like half human, half animals. I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's a fact that happened in history.
What's so weird, though, is that we have examples of cheetahs and then we have examples of humans, but you don't see in the wild anymore humans with cheetah heads, right? So at some point, I guess they were just split off, or they just said, we're not doing this anymore. But I mean, it's just interesting to me how you can put an animal head like that, hair, everything, on just a physical body. Same with the half horse, you know, centaurs or anything like that. Like, it's very interesting. Like, where do those origins come from? Like, were they bred that way? You know what I mean? I mean, because our, you know, earth mind is going to sit here and say, okay, so some guy had it off with a cheetah, and then eventually, I guess, they made cheetah humans. And what does that look like? You know, so even that in itself is a rabbit hole to just go crazy on. What do you think about that? I'm just curious about your opinion. We won't hold you to this.
I think people who are interested can find more information and do their own research. But I think there are more important messages in the book that are more profound and also more imminent, that we really need to focus on that, which is to open our eyes up and to really wake up. I think there are more important messages in the book than half human, half animals.
See, I love that answer, because that's the kind of questions I ask, though. I'm just like, ooh, I want to know what you think about this. But yes, I also want to talk about the technology that allows them to just fly around everywhere, because they even say in here they were flying over a city, there were no roads, there was nothing like that, because they just didn't need them. No trains, no cars, like what you said. So what was the divide? The Tara and the Litolak, right?
Yes. So they use those kind of small handheld devices to, one is to really neutralize the gravitational force. They call that the gravity, they call that the cold magnetic force of the Earth. So it really it's the same word I used in another book called written by James Churchward that talks about Lemuria. So they also called gravity called magnetic force of the Earth. So I find that very interesting. And also they used another device to really move people around after neutralizing the gravity. And I think if that couldn't be invented, then a lot of the oil companies are going to go bankrupt.
This is one of the biggest arguments, man. This is one of the things that I think about constantly. And I think about this high technology being available to humans and how we'll find these people. And you could see news stories about this all the time. People invent a car that runs on water, or they can pull water out of the air, or they have ether and all of that kind of stuff, to where you're not dependent on petrol, on anybody, really. You can be completely self-sufficient. And then they're found dead, and then they suicided themselves and all this stuff. And so this is that next step. This is that breakthrough. One of the things I find so interesting is that this technology is out there. The U.S. government allegedly has it, like you alluded to earlier, and I don't disagree with you. And that though it's not going to be released to the public, so not without something tremendous going on. So do you think that you'll ever see that in your lifetime?
I definitely will. I'm trying to spread the information and the knowledge that people can do themselves. And it's not very easy to, it's not very difficult to do, but they cannot really apply for patents because they relate it to national security. Because if they know about patent law, anything that involves national security cannot be patented. So they have to really have this kind of altruistic goal in mind to serve the public, to serve the people, really have to make this technology and the products public immediately. It's really something just, if you think about the vibrations, you can use a specific frequency to break the covalence bond between hydrogen and oxygen in order to extract hydrogen from water molecules. I think that's, as long as someone can find that frequency and cause this kind of vibration, it's very easy to do. Many people have done that in the past, and there are YouTube videos showing that they have done that in the past. It's just that someone has to have the courage to commercialize it and to do it altruistically.
So you think that you'll see that in your lifetime?
I believe so, yes.
I love this. I love your attitude. I'm a boundless optimist like you. So I'm right there with you. I think we're going to see it too. There's going to take a shift, right, in the systems in place here for really for the people to take the power back. And hopefully that happens in a very nonviolent way. But we've seen in the past, and we've never really seen that in our history, in our written history that we're told about on this planet, just simply because we're not privy to that information. So I definitely want to talk about some of the messaging in the book, but I have a few more just woo-woo questions for you here. So Bermuda Triangle, talk to us about that.
Yes. There are many, it's a fact. People have to really do a lot of research on this, but it's a fact that many ships and planes vanish near the Bermuda Triangle. It's well documented. And what happened was that the Bermuda Triangle is a vortex, maybe like a portal, a warp that sucked the planes and ships that around it into a parallel universe. So inside a parallel universe, time stops and people don't feel any pain. And it's a very unique location, and that it's like a sphere floating around in different locations, and they constantly move to different locations. And I find that interesting because the book specifically mentioned that there are many, many places like this on Earth. Bermuda Triangle is probably the most well-known one, but there are other places too. Like there's a guy named David Pilates that documented many people who went missing in national parks in the US. So there are kind of clusters in different national parks that people tend to vanish a lot. And those are just very interesting and very strange cases. Like, for example, a man went missing, and then people find that man like a day later on the back of another mountain. It seems that it's impossible for that person to travel in such a long distance in such a short time. So there are a lot of other interesting documented cases that people went missing. And I suspect that the parallel universe is one of the explanations It's the explanation for some of the cases documented by David Pilates.
Yeah, the missing 411. I love this. And,
yes.
And one of the other, I'm sure you've heard this, about the Granada Treaty that they allegedly signed with Eisenhower. Have you heard about this, where they exchanged technology for the permission to take human beings?
Yes, I've heard of that. I think they signed a treaty with a grace, a little grace. And this is not written in the book, but Michel de Marquet, in a public lecture in 1995, specifically mentioned about the grace. They say that the grace, the Theobians say that the grace are actually from category one planet. They indeed implanted certain devices on people, but not as many as people claimed. Only about 150 people or so by 1995. And they did that because they really wanted to monitor how we respond to the increased, to the increasingly decreased immune system that we have. And we have had this kind of issue since 1948. I think when the year the atomic bomb exploded. So they also had the same issue, the grace. So they are a dying species. So they really wanted to learn how we respond to the same situation that they had in the past. So that's the whole reason of doing so. And the Theobians say that there is absolutely no danger of the implants. So they are also monitoring the grace activities to make sure that they don't harm us. So there's nothing to be afraid of. And I actually just had one friend of mine, a client of mine, who had this kind of encounter with Grace. And she suspected that she was implanted. And I told her not to worry about it. They cause no harm.
Yeah. And Dr. Roger Lear used to yank these out of people. And in his whole career, I think he pulled like 30 or so out, something like that. Do you remember the number? Do you know who I'm talking about?
No, I'm not.
Roger Lear. Oh, cool. Well, I'll send you something on him. Okay.
Okay.
So yes, and this is all fascinating. And then that was going to be my next question: is why did the Theobians allow interference on our planet from another species? But it's because Category One can mess with Category One, right?
Not really. I mean, as long as they don't interfere with our free will or interfere with our own like decision makings, I think those are kind of allowed. Remember, if you really like read between the lines in the book, the Theobians intervened with our activities many times in the past, but mostly for positive, but all for positive purposes, all for this kind of to induce our activities into the more spiritual path. They destroyed the two cities, Sodom and Gomorrah, and they, for a very good reason, because the people in the two cities punished the people who did the right thing or who helped others. So they punished the people who kind of were like cancer cells spreading the bad things to people who got in touch with them. So they had to destroy the two cities. They also intervened other things like helping the U.S. government to invent the atomic bomb at a much faster pace than Germany, because Germany at that time, according to the book, was also trying to develop an atomic bomb. They sided with the U.S. government, the lesser of the two devils, they believe the U.S. government was really sincere at that time to help the humanity, because otherwise, according to them, there would have been three times more death during World War II. So if you really think about that, they really didn't interfere with our free will. They kind of, in a way, they kind of helped us in a more indirect way.
You know, I guess I need to call Thao up then and let her know that she needs to come back, because there's cancers like Sodom and Gomorrah running our governments all over this place. And so if they are going to come back and intervene because people are being taken advantage of, hurt, children being hurt on a very deep level that we won't go into, all of those things, it seems like now we're ready for a Theuban renaissance more than ever. I mean, I don't know about you. Like, I don't know that we're any worse off than Germany, as far as the America and the U.S. go, as far as getting an atomic bomb. And same thing, like, Well, you know, it seems interesting that all these extraterrestrials or a lot of contactee reports talk about that they are very interested and obsessed with shutting down our nukes and taking those out. And so it's just interesting that I guess they helped us develop one. Now we've got it. But the bad guys, air quotes, the bad guys that they decided were bad, because there's also reports that the Greys teamed up with the Nazis, gave them a bunch of flying saucers and stuff. So it may have been a way to even the playing field. I think the interference thing is very interesting because it's all so subjective, and who convinced them that the U.S. government was doing the right thing? Because there's companies like Standard Oil. Standard Oil was ran by Rockefeller, and he provided the oil for the Nazi planes. So there was like U.S. funding Nazi airplanes to kill U.S. citizens. You know what I mean? So it's that type of, I guess, discretion on their part is very interesting. I would just like to have a conversation with Tao and be like, hey, check it out. We actually need you right now more than ever. Here's kind of my proposal on this. And then you go over to the U.S. government and tell me what they think about destroying our education system, our medical system, running everybody. This is just the way that I look at it. And a lot of people look at it. So it is interesting if they're going to intervene at all that they would have done it back then and only for the government, not the Nazis, which is also interesting because they say, a lot of people say, that the Nazis didn't surrender. A wonderful book called The Fourth Reich by Jim Mars, where the Nazis didn't surrender, Germany did. And this is where we get the world that we see today. A bunch of them went over to Argentina. And so, like, where's the, you know what I mean? I don't know. I have a lot of questions for Theubits. That's all I'm going to say. So
I can maybe get into some of your questions.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
They're actually doing this by, they're helping us right now by inviting Michel Demarquet to the planet. They did that a few times in the past. One of the most notable one was actually Enoch, in the Book of Enoch. Michel Demarquet specifically mentioned that Enoch was actually taken by Theubits to their planet, and just to show him and also to give him messages. And Enoch actually wrote a book as well. And if you really dig into history and to see what happened after Enoch wrote that book, what happened, you're going to find very interesting things. Enoch is, I think, the grandfather of Noah, right? And I think,
yes,
or great-grandfather.
Yeah.
So if you see what happened after Enoch was invited by Theubits to their planet, and if you look at what happened afterwards, so this is like a warning to us. We have to really mend our ways and to really help ourselves, because according to them, God helps those who help themselves. And this is the reason why I'm so desperate in spreading the messages. I'm asking for people's help. I'm getting as many shows as possible just to reach a wider audience. And people really have to take these messages seriously. And it has to come from the people, not from the government. Because major revolutions or changes always come from the bottom, not from bottom up, not from top down. So we really have to get the people's act together and to change our ways so the government can change.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of like a ice cube or like a glacier or something like that. When it gets too full and too tall, it flips over, right?
Yeah.
And so it seems like if the government gets too high and powerful and we're just over it, then floop, the table switch. So kind of like a pole shift or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's literally a pole shift, an energy shift. So I think it's interesting. I could debate why aliens or talk to you about why aliens come here and decide to do what they do all day long. But I definitely want to at least touch on Christ. So Jesus Christ, man, tell us about that.
Well, before I read this book, I didn't believe a single word in the Bible, because it's just the Bible just didn't make any sense to me. But after I read this book, it made total sense to me, especially the New Testament. And so Jesus, actually, there are two Jesus, one born out of Virgin Mary. And he really couldn't perform miracles. He traveled to India and to China and died in Japan. So there is a tomb of Jesus Christ in Shingo Village, Japan. That Jesus was highly spiritual and very intelligent, very smart, but he couldn't perform miracles because he forgot everything. When one reborn, so when reincarnates, one had to go through like the river of oblivion, forgetting everything happened in the past lives, forgetting all the knowledge to perform miracles. So that Jesus implanted into Virgin Mary's embryo, the uterus with embryo, was the Jesus who really like died in Japan at the age of 105. And people can check it out. The Shingo Village, Japan, there's a tomb of Jesus Christ. But the Christ who could perform miracles was actually one of the Theobans. And because he really was someone who remembered everything, remembered what was going to happen to him, he was able to perform all the miracles as documented in the New Testaments of the Bible, the four Gospels. And especially after reading this book, Theoba Prophecy, I think any reasonable person who really wants to be more spiritual would really want to research what really did Jesus Christ teach in the New Testament, and how we can learn from his teachings. And I think this is a very interesting thing that I've been really working on, is to let Christians know that there's another possibility that Christ actually was one of the ETs.
What I love is if Christians love anything, it's to be told that actually your Messiah was an alien. So like that's I know that you're probably being received pretty well on that. I love this dude. I think that's so cool. Yeah, and it's fascinating because then there's that missing time in the Bible and, you know, all of these very interesting things, and even the concept of like an immaculate birth or like a virgin birth, right? Because Mary wasn't a virgin necessarily. She just didn't do the beast with two backs to make Jesus. Basically, there was something implanted in a gap, right? Like they hadn't been intimate in a while or something like that. But this is very interesting as well, because then, like you said, being birthed gives you that, what'd you call it, the river of amnesia? River of illusion. Yes, I love that, by the way. That's amazing. So one of the things that's interesting that I heard somebody point out the other day that's, yes, not in the book, but it was about Adam and Eve and how they weren't born, right? They were, as the story goes, they were built, right, out of stuff here and part of God, but they weren't birthed like from a vagina and all that stuff. But Cain was. And so one of the interesting things this guy was pointing out was that the first human ever was a murderer. You know what I mean? So that, what does that tell you about the human race and what happened to us after that? Is the very first person that slipped out of that birth canal and went through the river of illusion, ended up just being horrible and nobody that you wouldn't want to hang out with, that guy, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, so a couple more things here. I could just talk to you about this stuff forever, dude. Okay, let's definitely talk, while we're on Bible themes, about Moses and the Jews. So tell us about what the book says about that.
Well, Moses really led the Hebrews out of Egypt. And part of what happened was that the Theobans were involved in parting the Sea of Reeds, not the Red Sea, but the Sea of Reeds. This has been verified by a lot of scholars who did a lot of research on what happened in Exodus. It's really not the Red Sea, but the Sea of Reeds. And Moses was actually not a Hebrew, but an Egyptian, according to this book. And there are a lot of interesting details. And the reason they chose the Hebrews or the Jewish people was very interesting, because the Hebrews or the Jewish people came from Category 3 planet. It's not written in the book, but Michel de Marquet told me personally that Jewish people actually came from a Category 3 planet by accident, totally by accident. They fell on Earth. Their spaceship had a technical issue, so they had to land on Earth. So they fell to Earth by accident. They had to survive in a very kind of difficult environment, because we are Category 1. So they encountered a lot of difficulties, and they're still encountering a lot of difficulties nowadays. So I would suggest people to read the book, and I'm not going to be able to elaborate more because it's a little bit controversial, but it's very interesting.
It is. And if you're going to be controversial, this is the show. But absolutely, okay. I love your style. We will absolutely refer to the book on this. So definitely wanted to talk about the Dokos as well. Now, this is back on the Golden Planet here. So what are the Dokos?
The Dokos are the building structures where they live on planet Theoba. So they were built by a very interesting force in which they have a core. The core emits this kind of force field. When people enter it, they could feel the force field. After they enter it, they can see totally outside. So from inside to outside, everything is transparent. But from outside to inside, people will not be able to see anything inside. And birds can land on the docals, and some of the docals are kind of like eggs, upright eggs. Some of them are like eggs laying down. So they're kind of like chicken eggs or something like that. And one interesting, towards the end of Michel de Marquette's journey, he was led into a golden doco, which is a very, very special structure. He was shown other kinds of ETs, the corpse of other ETs. So there are about close to 200 ETs. And he was told that in our galaxy, so there are other ETs that the Theobans helped throughout history. So it's kind of implying that we are not the only one that they have been helping. So among the three category 9 planets in our galaxy, Theoba is one of them, and they have helped close to 200 ETs, including us. So in a sense, they're the more superior guys that we should look up to, and we should really follow their directions. And I always believe in learn from the best and know everything there is. And if we are to learn from the best, then Theobans are the people to learn from, and not the grays, because the grays are category 1. So this tells you something. If you really want to learn from the more advanced ETs, get this book.
Absolutely do it. And it's so interesting that they have just like a collection. It reminded me of the collector from Nowhere, from the Avengers movies, you know, where he just has all these species of things. I think Howard the Duck was trapped there too. So it just kind of reminded me of that, which was very interesting. And there's so many things about this book and about the Golden Planet. And he even says it in there that it's not so alien and foreign. It's something that you can look at and recognize. It's not like going to a fractal other dimension where things are just crazy and people have like 9 faces and they're all geometrically changing all the time. Like really something difficult to conceptually wrap your mind around, have how the just how it works conceptually. But even things like people flying, the eggs, I mean, all of these things, yes, it's a structure. We have homes here. When you go into our homes, you have to physically open something, walk in, and then they need to be maintained, and you can only see out if there's a transparent window, which people can also see back in. But in there, they have these home structures, these docos, that you can walk in, and they're completely transparent on the inside. I like Karin's question that she asked you, that she just was thinking the whole time, where they hang their paintings, you know, where they have their art at. I thought that was cute. But then from the outside, you can't see in it at all. So you do have that privacy, which is very interesting, man. I love this. I love everything about this. So what about, I definitely want to touch on former lives with you. So former lives, tell us about what the book says about that.
So we exist in our physical bodies, but we also have astral bodies. So when a person dies, the astral body leaves the physical body and then gets united with the higher self. And then there's a life review process to see how the person did in his life or her life. And the person would be able to feel how the other people felt when the person did something, whether good or bad. And then there are other spiritual lessons to learn, and the higher self would also give and fall to another physical body or of a baby and to be reborn, to be reincarnated again. So Michel de Marquette was shown his previous 80 lives in a very special way, and he actually experienced how his previous 80 lives were in a very short time, like a brief segment of it. And he was a mining worker in Germany. He was a few times a beggar on the street. He was a queen ruling a third of the planet on another planet. And he was also a few times a mystic, or maybe like a hermit. And he experienced everything. They tell him that life or different lives are kind of different locations on a wheel. One has to experience everything in order to learn the full lessons of life, the meaning of life. So one has to be like everyone, like the richest person and the poorest person, in order to experience everything and to learn all the spiritual lessons one has to learn in his or her own life. And so life is a learning process. And I think it's important to know that there is life after death and there is reincarnation. And this is what actually Jesus was trying to show us through his resurrection after 3 days. 3 days is a very interesting number because according to Michel Demarquet, Tao told him that 81% of the electrons of the astral body remains on Earth after 3 days, and then gets reunited with the higher self. So after one pass away, 81% of electrons remain on Earth for 3 days. And then there is also the other 19% that remains on Earth forever until it's recycled by nature, or when the person reincarnates, that the other 19% goes into the embryo or the baby.
That's something that's so wild to me, is this idea of, and you, this also ties into ghosts, absolutely, with this extra 19%, because that's kind of just what hangs out around here. Now, what if you don't reincarnate on Earth, and then your energy, just 19% of your energy of that lifetime that you had here, the electrons of that lifetime, they stay here until forever, or somebody else just comes along like, well, if you're not going to eat it, I'll take it. You know what I mean? Kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like that. Until they're recycled by nature, either by plants or animals or by people. So there are people who just kind of dispels or kind of get rid of the ghosts. They do that in a certain way, and they just let the electrons get recycled or by nature or something like that. So I find that fascinating because there's a lot of fear to ghosts, and there is no need to fear ghosts because if you think about that, they're just electrons. They have memories of what happened to that person when the person was alive. So that's why they always haunt the places they loved or hated. They also have, because of static forces, they resemble the person when the person was alive. But if you really don't like the ghosts, just use a lighter, because fire can cause the electrons to separate, or maybe to get rid of the electrons. So yeah. I think, just use fire.
Yeah, or a desert, because I've heard also high humidity is where you get ghosts and these apparitions from, because it can form in the high humidity of the molecules in the air. So if you just have a super arid, dry place, like not a lot of ghosts running around the desert, I guess. That's one of the implications. I think Mike Ricksecker talked about that on the show, and I just found that fascinating. That's just such an interesting thing. And so now I'm thinking these people who do ghost hunts and who send ghosts onto the other side. You know, you hear about all of that's a very common thing. Oh, I have to send this ghost. I have to let them pass over. It's that confusion. All of that is an interesting thing because it's just sort of like an energetic echo of the person that was here. Kind of like if somebody invented an AI bot of you, it would have every like search engine, all of your possibilities, all of your qualities. So it would mimic you, but it's not really you because you're already 81% of you is over on Thaluba hanging out with Thou and flying around, right? But really, it's like this energetic imprint that kind of can mimic it's not really you. It's just a small, small, small part of you, you know, which I found very interesting that was talked about in here. Okay, so we got ghosts, we got the mind power was something that we definitely touched on that I was so interested about, but we're not going to get to it. We're going to refer back to the book, guys. Definitely check Samuel out. I'm going to be linking all of the ways to find him. I'll let you have the last word here, man, but I mean, the Thaluba Prophecy, absolutely incredible, guys. Definitely, I mean, I know I talk about a lot of books on here, but man, this one is fascinating, and it connects so many themes like we talk about on the show here, so I find it very valuable, and I think you guys will get a huge kick out of this. And Samuel, I can't thank you enough, man, for coming by and hanging out. You're welcome back anytime, because I have so many more questions for you. So this was a delight, dude, so thank you so much, brother. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
谢谢我的朋友。再见。
谢谢。再见。
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.